guest speaker for the night will be Bill from Torrance, California.
Hi, I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. It's been a long day. We left early this morning. I was supposed to be here last Thanksgiving, or the day before Thanksgiving. I'm a little late. And that day, of course, was a Wednesday, and I left at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, along with the rest of Los Angeles. And it was raining, and about almost 4 hours later, I'd gone about 20, 25 miles, and I was still in Long Beach. So I gave up. And so today, to come down here, I left at 7:45 this morning. we got into Oceanside about 9:30 and went and played some golf with another sick alcoholic that lives down here that moved from Los Angeles. It seems like most of us are moving down here. I don't know why that is, but when I see all the construction, I kind of, there must be a reason. And so I got here on time this time. I was born and raised in Los Angeles around Inglewood in Westchester. And I graduated from high school in 1965. So I'm a child of the 60s. I survived, I think. Part of it is a little dark. I lost most of my hair and a few brain cells. I heard a guy the other night say that he came to Alcoholics Anonymous and he had two brain cells and they were arguing. You relate to that. It's always good to know the room you're in, you know. My father did a very strange thing when I was 6 years old. He decided to get sober. And that was 34 years ago. He's still sober. He's a little weird, but he hasn't drank for a long time. And he was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And 34 years ago, the hospitals hadn't figured out that they could make money off of it. And there was no place to take us. And if we were in bad shape, the hospitals wouldn't take us. So he brought them home. And some of my earliest memories were of drunks in the living room in various conditions of recovery. And you know, big, wet, wine-soaked kisses and stuff like that. And I would come home from school, and I'd walk home from school, and there would be a drunk laying on the back porch waiting for who I now understand was their sponsor to return. Sometimes they were sober. A lot of times they weren't. And I would get them up and bring them in the house and clean them up before my dad got home so he wouldn't see them in that condition. You know? And I can remember being in AA meetings, at the end of the meeting, standing around holding hands like this, going, keep coming back, you know. And I'd bring out the donuts during the break, during the intermission. And I now take cakes with my father. Our sobriety dates are one day apart. And I take cakes with him in some of those meetings that he started 30 years ago. And it's a real special thing to do that. At the time, growing up as an AA brat was not fun. I mean, like, I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I knew that it wasn't a bunch of old men and women in overcoats sitting under bridges not drinking. You know, I knew what you looked like and who you were, and I'd been to all the barbecues and the Labor Day picnics and all the stuff, you know. Chuck C. and my father got sober together, and we would go to his house, which was a real AA house. And the Roxbury Men's Stag was one of the big heavy hitters up there. You know, it still is. You know, if you never get a chance to go there, it's really a riot. But we would go there. I mean, I knew all those guys and stuff. And a lot of the friends of our family, now I realize, are all alcoholics. I didn't really realize it at the time. But I don't recommend growing up in AA. Especially if you want to drink, you know, it just, you know. And like a lot of us know that that mental quirk starts before we drink. You know, like I have always been in trouble. You know, always. You know, I was always in trouble. I was always causing some shit. You know, and I was always in somebody's face, and somebody was always in my face. And it was just trouble constantly. You know, and at 14 years old, I think when it was when I started drinking, it got worse. And my attitude got better because I really didn't give a shit then. You know, I mean, it just really was, it was awful. It was awful living in my house. My parents were two of the most boring human beings I had ever come in contact in all my years of 12 years old, you know. I mean, these people were a drag, you know. And I would go to other kids' house, and their parents were partying, you know. I mean, these kids were having a good time, you know. I mean, my parents were like sober and always there. You know? Awful, you know. I mean, I can remember being on a phone one time with a friend of mine, and the friend was saying, yeah, my old man got drunk again, and they hauled him up and stuff. And I sat there, and I went, yeah, my old man got drunk again, too, and they hauled him up just to be like everybody else, you know. I mean, my old man was stone cold, goddamn sober, sitting in the living room watching television, you know, night after night, you know. And the worst thing that ever, I hated my father. I hated his guts, you know, with an intensity that just drove my life for years. When I was 13 years old, I started having, like, anger seizures where I would just double over and hit my knees. My mother took me to a shrink to find out what was wrong. And I just hated him. I prayed for his death. You know, I mean, I just really hated him intensely. When I got around to that goddamn ninth step and I had to look at that, I couldn't remember why. I couldn't remember why. I mean, he never beat me. He never molested me. The worst thing he did is he neglected me. He ignored me. It wasn't even neglect. It was just, no, he was busy, man. He was going to meetings and he was doing his thing and he started a business and stuff like this. He was just a busy guy, you know. I mean, I lived in a real nice home. I mean, it was very middle class and very comfortable, you know. I didn't grow up in a ghetto somewhere. I didn't have any of those excuses, you know. And my father, as some of you have been sober for even just a little while, realize, you know, what happens to people in sobriety is we joke, we laugh about it, but they do get spiritual. You know, we do. I mean, our lives have been saved, and we realize it. You know, so we have a life, albeit not perfect, certainly has some sort of a spiritual base in it. And that's the way my house was. You know, and I hated it. It was boring, you know. And I left a lot, you know. I mean, get the hell out of there. 1965, I graduated from high school, barely. And I left home, man. I pulled my car out of the driveway, and I was waving, boy, goodbye, assholes. You know? And my parents were standing there by the doorway looking at me, smiling, going, goodbye, asshole. They were glad to be rid of me. We hated each other. It just was awful. It was that last couple of years living there was really, it was really awful. Especially when you get big enough to really get in your dad's face, and he realizes that he can't beat you up anymore, you know. And there were those confrontations at the door in the kitchen in the morning at breakfast, like, fuck you, Will, fuck you, Will, fuck you! just like that, you know? So it was 1965. It was 1965, you know? San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, was really in bloom. You know, as George Carlin says, pot swept the neighborhood, you know? And so I started mixing my alcohol with other stuff that was available. The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was definitely the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. We weren't just getting loaded. We were making a political statement. You know? The young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. I can remember, you know, people sleeping by parking meters in the street, and we'd walk by putting money in the parking meter because they couldn't bust you. It was your property as long as there was money, you know. And it was wonderful. It was fun. It was fun, and it was working, and it was summer all the time, you know. And it was, you could hitchhike, and it was safe, you know. Nothing bad was happening, it seemed like. For some odd reason, at 19, I decided to get married. I have no explanation for that, but I did it. And we moved to Oregon, went back to the earth, and got a trailer out in the woods and grew our own. And by the time I was 21 years old, I think, 21 or 22, I ended up in the Oregon State Mental Institution. And I had lost a house, a couple of cars, several jobs, a wife and two children, actually. I mean, I lost a family and everything that goes along with that, all the properties and possessions of that. And I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution, and I was injecting heroin and methadrine on a daily basis off and on, taking a lot of LSD, drinking all the time, eating 50 whites a day and reds and all the stuff we do, you know. I mean, we were children of the 60s, you know. And our alcoholism, my alcoholism was aided and abetted by a lot of drugs. I could cop to being a drug addict then. I mean, James Taylor did. It was like it was a sign. It was a badge of honor. You know, yeah, I'm a drug addict, aren't you? What's your problem, man? How come your hair's so short? Are you sick? And it just, you know, it's just I had an attitude. See, my story is, you know, kind of the things I was. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I couldn't surf very well. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. So everywhere I was a rude place. You know, I mean, I never was where I belonged. And you couldn't, if you'd have asked me then when I was each one of those things, if that was true, I'd deny it. You know, I looked like those things. You know, I how do you like my suit? Yeah. This is Christmas, yeah, you know, and it covers up the tattoos real nice. You know, you look good. Well, I looked good on a Harley, you know. I mean, I had a chrome Nazi helmet and a primary chain for a belt, but I wore a clip-on earring, you know. And I just remembered that the other day. A guy told me it was a clip-on. Man. I was a phony, you know. I was a phony. I was scared to death. Most of the time, I was scared to death, really, you know. And I think what really put me in the nut house was not the drugs so much. Of course, it had a lot to do with it, but was the lifestyle scared me, you know, frightened me. You know, I mean, the people I was running with carried guns, and they had a tendency to shoot them once in a while, and it was a frightening place to be, you know, for a wimp, you know, which is basically what I am. I'm a wimp, you know. I've always been a physical coward. You know, if you confronted me, if you had the balls to confront me, you know, I'd back down. If it was really going to happen, I'd back down. But you get used to it. I'm sure there's a lot of good actors in here. You get used to it. You can walk into a place and you can frighten people. If you're big enough, you can frighten them. You know, if you've got enough weapons on you, you can frighten them. And I would do that. You know, I'd pull guns on people and stuff like that and scare the shit out of them. And they'd run away from me. And but if I ever got confronted by somebody who was real, who really was that way, really that way, I would run every time. And I have. And that doesn't build a lot of self-esteem. Well, anyway, I ended up in the nut house. And after that, I went out and tried to kill a guy. And fortunately, I didn't find him. And the state of Oregon decided it was time for me to leave. And I agreed. So they waved, and I waved, and off I went. And I left my wife and children up there. And I was living in my car. But I didn't really notice that. You know, I mean, it's like hindsight. You look back, you know, I was living in my car. You know, and but it didn't seem like that. I mean, you know, people always talk about living in their car, and then I hear that, and I go, I wonder if it seemed like that to them, you know? I mean, I was living in my car. I would sleep in my car, and I would go from house to house, and I had nowhere to live, you know? I was collecting unemployment. I came back down here and looked up some old high school buddies and would start bumming off of them. And what happened to me then is off and on during this period of time, I was going to a lot of therapy, and I ended up back in therapy again when I came back down here. For 2.5 years, I was in group therapy, and I met another woman. I cleaned up my act. I quit sticking needles in my arm, and I quit doing a lot of the overt stuff that we do, you know. I mean, I think that a lot of alcoholics, at least of my generation, have a strange affinity for hallucinogenic drugs, you know. It kind of adds a paisley texture to the drunk, you know, and it makes linoleum floors more interesting when you're laying on them, you know. And it doesn't seem like a toilet when you're puking in it and stuff. You know? Something else, you know. And I quit doing all that. And I met a woman, and I got a job working for my father in his business that was failing at the time. And I became normal. And what normal was to me, and this was something I consciously did, I'm going to clean up my act now. It's time for me to straight. I had learned a lot about myself, you know, in this therapy thing. I learned what's really going on with Bill, and I was delving into this anger and hatred for my father and trying to come to terms with all these things. And I got to clean up my act, you know. So what I did to become normal is I would drink on the weekends and smoke dope during the week. And smoking dope is not getting loaded. It's what you do in between getting really high. It's just maintenance, you know. And I figured, you know, that's what I would do. And I did that. And I was successful at that for, 8 or 10 years. I did that. And this woman that I met, we got married. And for 10 years, we had no children. And we just, you know, we were free. She was working, I was working. We had pretty good money. And things got better. Each year would go by, things got better. We moved into a better house. And finally, we bought a house. And the business kind of turned around. My father retired, and I started making more money. Things were going really well. And all the time, my drinking got worse and got worse and it got worse and it got worse constantly. You know, consistently, it would get worse. And pretty soon, it wasn't just weekends. It was Wednesdays, too, and this type of thing. But it was a slow progression, you know. Alcoholism, for me, started right off the bat. When I drank, the first time I ever drank, I drank alcoholically. You know, I drank, I got sick, I threw up in my record player. It was an old Webcore, it had a lid on it, you know, and I threw up in it and closed the lid. Nobody. And when I was, say, 30 years old, the same thing was happening. Every time I drank, I got drunk. I see absolutely no reason to drink socially. You know, whatever that is. I know a lot of people have. You start off drinking and pretty soon you cross the line. Well, I crossed the line at 14 years old. And anything I ever did to alter my consciousness, I did to excess. Always. So as this thing got worse, every time I drank, I would get drunk. You know, the weekends were just a blur. And then pretty soon it started going into the week. And then as the business became more successful and it became larger, I didn't have to do all the 16-hour days at work anymore, you know, as much. I could leave and I could do what I wanted. I could split. And pretty soon it got worse. Then my wife had a child. And she had to stay home. She had this kid, you know. And I would go off. And pretty soon then I wasn't coming home. You know, all of a sudden she was stuck at home. I had nobody there with me to say, well, it's time to go home now, Bill. You know, it's time to go home. That helps when you have that person, you know. For a while, then pretty soon you go, what the fuck you mean it's time to go home? You know, and then it would cause arguments, you know. Well, she pretty just let me go. And then I was gone and the drinking got worse. At 37 years old, which is when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, next month I'll be 4 years sober. And so I have a lot of opinions and I'm also very spiritual, so I hope you'll forgive me, especially people with some time, you know. I think it's our job to have opinions at 4 years sober. And I mean, aren't we the ones? Somebody has the opinions in AA. I think it's us. And we run AA, by the way. People with 5 years and less, that's who runs Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you were anybody, newcomers were wondering, I'm running for president. What happened to me at 37 years old, I weighed over 300 pounds. I just was, you know, and I hurt everywhere. I had been drunk in a bar one night a couple of years prior to that, and some people took exception to my opinions and threw me down some stairs, and I had broken my ankle, so I walked with a limp. Because you have 300 pounds on an ankle that's got pins and screws in it, it limps. I had a bad knee. I had a pinched nerve, but ended up being a pinched tendon in my shoulder, so my right arm was kind of gimped up, and I would hold it to my side like this. My liver stuck out on one side, and I had a real bad liver count, you know. Doctor asked you that great question, you know, do you drink much? A couple of beers, you know. And a few years prior to that, I had found my true drug of choice, which is gin. Gin worked for me. And at 37, when I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the party had stopped a long time ago, but it would get rid of the physical pain every time. I would supplement it with a little this and that, but I started off at 14 years old drinking. I ended up at 37. All I could do was drink. I couldn't smoke dope anymore. It made me paranoid, scared the shit out of me. And all I could do was drink, and I just drank every day. And the last year, I couldn't not drink. I had to drink, and I knew that. That's an awful place to be. It was for me when I would sit in my office or wherever I was and knew that I was going to drink. You know, I mean, I just knew I was going to drink because I couldn't not drink. It had me, literally had me. What happened for me is at 5 o'clock in the morning one morning, sitting in my Cadillac in a three-piece suit. I had just bought the car, and I was sitting in a three-piece suit. I had a wife at home with two children in a home that I bought. And she told me a long time ago, please don't call me at night. I don't care where you are. I'm sleeping very soundly. Don't wake me up. You know. And her story is that she just made sure that the insurance premiums were paid up and maybe this time the son of a bitch wouldn't come home. And that's, there was no arguments in our house at all. There was just dead silence. That booming dead silence. In a drunken blur one night, through the prodding of another psychiatrist that I went to see, I confessed to her, because I wanted to get honest in our relationship, about using prostitutes, which was a real neat thing to do. And it just killed whatever she had left, whatever feeling she had left for me at the time. It just killed it completely. She didn't have the type of family that could take her in, so it was purely a financial situation. She just stayed there. You know, and she was planning on getting out. She had a place lined up to get out, but I screwed up. I got sober on her. You know? She didn't want to look bad, you know. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, sitting in my car with another guy in the car, I started telling him I had to stop this. I couldn't do this anymore. I just couldn't keep it up anymore. And I got him out of the car, and I went and I called my mother, and I said, you got to come and help me. I'm screwed up. There was nobody left in my life. My mouth had alienated everybody from me completely. You know, I was not a happy drunk anymore. You know, I was argumentative. I was very political, and I'd talk anything that would cause a fight, I would do. You know, and if you didn't agree with me, you were just an asshole. And I'd sit there and argue and try and change your mind. You know, so I was alone, completely alone. People come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about when I got here, I was completely alone. You know, I think some people say that, oh, there must have been somebody. Well, I understand that. There was nobody. There was nobody left in my life. You know, so the only person I could think of that would come and help me was my mother. And I called my mother. I said, Mommy, you know, you got to come and get me. I'm screwed up. You know, and I was afraid I was going to die. I was having chest pains, anxiety attacks in the middle of the night, where my chest just felt like it was just going to pound right out of me. You know, and I'd wake my wife up and I'd put her hand on my chest and I'd go, do you feel that? And she'd go, no. And I'd go, never mind. You know, scared to death. You know, I'd get up in the middle of the night and I'd go sit in the toilet till it would pass. You know, I don't know why I did that. You know, I guess I didn't want to die in front of anybody, you know. And kind of stupid. So she took me to a hospital and I spent a month in the hospital and I got out and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. My big book, I got away pretty cheap. It cost me $8,000, I think. You know, I was there for 35 days. And, you know, I mean, that was my M.O. When things got too tough, I just institutionalized myself, put myself away. And so I spent 35 days in there. They used to let us out to go to the drugstore and stuff, and I wouldn't leave. I was afraid to leave the hospital. For 35 days, I stayed inside that building. I wouldn't go out. Because I just knew I was going to get drunk. I knew I was going to get loaded or something. There's no way I could just go to meetings and stay sober. I couldn't comprehend living life without drinking. Well, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first night I got out, I looked up a directory thing. I called a guy, and I went to the Gong Show. It's a meeting on Friday night at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club. It should be experienced. It's a special meeting. Special. There are many who don't believe it's a meeting. You know, I kind of agree with that. But I went to that meeting, and I went up there, and I took a 30-day chip in all my 300-pound glory. And after about 2 weeks, I found a sponsor. This guy is about this tall. He's short. He's younger than me. I don't think he's as well educated. He's a Nazi, is what he is. He's just a Nazi. He's a Nazi, you know. And he said awful things to me. And hurt my feelings deeply. He still does. I think he gets pleasure from it. You know, I really, there's something. Some sponsors are not human, and this guy is like that. I have no idea why I picked him, but I saw him in meetings or something, and I went up to him and asked him, "Will you be my sponsor?" He says, "I'll meet you at the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag Monday night. Be there at 8 o'clock. The meeting starts at 8:30. Meet me there at 8 o'clock, and we'll discuss it." I said, "Well, I had something else I wanted to do that Monday night." He goes, "Well, I don't care. You know, just be there if you want to talk to me, be there." So I showed up. I showed up at the meeting, and he took me around the corner, and he asked me a few questions. And he asked me, the first question they always ask you, I think, is, are you willing to go to any lengths to not drink? So I'd been in the hospital, and they grill you with one of the things that hospitals are neat. They give you like a list of all the cliches and stuff, you know, so that you know, and you kind of you're prepared for this stuff. And I lied and said yes. And I suggest that any of you who are new, that when you hit on a sponsor and he asks you that, he or she asks you that, you just lie and say yes for several reasons. One, you have no idea what they really mean by that statement, you know. And if you say no, you got to listen to them for another 10 minutes or so. I told him yes. And then the next thing he said to me, and I will never forget this, he says, I noticed that in the meetings, you identify yourself as an alcoholic and an addict. And I said, well, yeah, you know, that's what I did, a lot of drugs, you know, and that's what they taught me to do in the hospital. You know, I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. And he says, well, I might make this suggestion to you. He says, if you're calling yourself an addict because you think it's a little hipper and a little slicker and a little cooler, you might want to drop it and be like everybody else. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and you might want to, for the first time in your life, be just like everybody else. And he looked me right in the eye when he said that, you know, and I could feel the anger well up from inside and go up my neck, and my veins started to bulge, you know, my face turned red, and the thing that went through my head is, who the fuck do you think you are, you know? And I just swallowed that like that, you know, and we went into the meeting. Later on that day, or a couple days later, I thought about what really made me mad was he's right. I was looking for something to be a little bit different because, see, I'm not like you. I'm unique. I'm special. I'm not just an alcoholic. I'm other things, too. You know? And I'm not like the old guy over there, you know. I'm a hipper kind of a guy. You know, in all my 300-pound glory, you know. And I had to sit and hear that, you know. I had to hear that, and he said that to me. Through my relationship with my sponsor, I will always be grateful that I found somebody who loved me enough to tell me the truth and not just what I wanted to hear. He never cared about what I wanted to hear. And he told me, he says, come over to my house Thursday at 5 o'clock. Read the doctor's opinion in the big book, and we'll talk about it. And make notes in the margin, and we'll discuss this. Okay? So I read the thing, and I made the notes, and I went over to his house. And he told me a little bit about himself, you know, at that time, at that initial meeting. We read the doctor's opinion. In the doctor's opinion, it describes four or five different kinds of alcoholics. And we picked out the one that I am. We found me in there, and we circled that and said, that's Bill. He's that kind of an alcoholic. And in there we found Jay. He described to me, this is the kind of alcoholic I was. He says, I was sticking needles in my arm when I was 15 years old. You know, I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, I mean, we had something we could share. All of a sudden it didn't seem so unique anymore. You know, this guy did, I did have something in common with him, maybe. Later on in that passage in the book, it talks about what the alcoholic needs if he's going to survive is a complete psychic change. We determined that that's what I needed, that my psyche was a little tweaked and it should be changed, that maybe if my perception of the world around me was a little bit different, I could live a little more comfortably not drinking. Okay. And I agreed with that. I thought, God, that's kind of neat, you know, because I'd read that before, but I never read it with anybody. And he made me read it to him out loud because he didn't trust that I'd actually read it. You know, I thought that was kind of significant, you know. The next week I went over there and we read Bill's story and we circled some stuff in there and we thought things that I identified with and things that I didn't identify with. And he told me, he says, if anybody asks you, you're on the first step, by the way. This is a 12-step program. What you and I are going to do is work these steps. So if anybody asks what step you're on the first step. We read Bill's story, then we read the next chapter. He says, okay, now you're on the second step. Well, the steps to me, I could read them and stuff, you know, and I could look at the first step and I could say, yeah, I'm powerless. I could cop to that because I was real sick. My life is unmanageable. I was intelligent enough to know that doesn't mean that you don't have any money. It means that there's nobody in your life. There's probably a good, you know, indication that you're a little unmanageable. People don't like you and stuff. My life is definitely unmanageable. My wife hated my guts about this time. She was really getting in touch with that. She was telling me. You know, she sat me down one day and she said, I have something I want to tell you, in case you were wondering. I hate your guts, you know. And she was crying, and this is a real moment for her. You know, when you live with somebody and you know they hate you, it's kind of almost a relief when they finally cop to it, you know, and say, I just really hate your guts. You know, you've hurt me a lot. And I realize that I can't make you drunk or anything, so I'm telling you how I really feel. And I'd run to my sponsor and go, she hates my guts. And he'd look at me and go, no shit, you're an asshole. You know, I've been therapied by some pretty good people. So I knew probably more about myself than was really necessary to know. And I was getting in touch with emotions and stuff. And he would say things to me like, your emotions are as fucked up as you're thinking. Keep it to yourself, please. God, aren't I supposed to vent it? He goes, I don't want to hear that crap. I really don't want to. And please don't do it in the meetings. You know, if you have a real problem, come and talk to me, but don't do it in the meetings. It's embarrassing, man. You know, jeez, you know, and I was, God, it's awful. You know? One time he looked at me and I was going on about this. The first step talks about powerlessness and unmanageability. The second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves was going to restore us to sanity. And as far as I was concerned, if you believed in a power greater than yourself, you were insane. You know? So I didn't want to hear anything about this God shit. I wasn't stupid enough to be an atheist. You know, I had gone through my atheistic period. You know, I mean, at one time or another, if you were in the 60s, we all went through a phase of communism, you know. And I'd carry my Mao's Little Red Book and stuff, you know. And so I was a real good atheist, and I preached it. Then I got involved in another intellectual pursuit that said atheism is irrational because it's a belief in nothing. And, of course, there must be a source for all natural phenomena. For lack of a better term, we'll call that God. Whether it's intelligent or not is unknowable. And that's called being a deist. And deism, what a deist is an agnostic with a title. You know, so and I could give you a bibliography about this, and I could discuss it with you. And so I was an intelligent guy, and I would discuss this with my sponsor, and he would look at me and he'd say, resign from the debating society. We don't give a shit what you think. Doesn't matter what you think. It's irrelevant what you think. You're going to work this program or you're out the door. It's time for you to work this program. Your program got you here. So shut up. You know, I don't want to hear it. Another time he sat there and I was going on about this, and you got to hear this, man. This book is stupid. It's just stupid. And one of the notes I made in the margin was, one of the notes was he was talking about God, he was talking about the Wright brothers and stuff like this, you know, and I put, illogical thought process. You know, I would make little notes like that, you know, and, different things like this, and I would discuss this with him, you know, and he looked at me one time, and he looked, and he just yawned right in my face. You know, God, and another time, the worst one that he did, when we were sitting on the beach, he lives right on the beach, you know, we were sitting on the beach in the sand, we're going through all this stuff, and he looked at me, and he tried to control himself. Actually, he turned his face away from me, and he laughed and spit all over himself. You know? He told me, he says, I thought you were going to hit me, and I said, I almost did, man. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, he says, well, you were so stupid, you know. He told me, around that time is when he told me, he said, you either have faith or you don't, man. There's no middle ground. He says, I'm not going to argue this with you. I'm not going to debate it with you. It doesn't matter what you think. That's the point. What you think is irrelevant, you know, because you're here now. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and a power greater than yourself is going to restore you to sanity. That's it. Doesn't go any further than that. And you can, I mean, they give you the chicken gate. You know they're talking about God, but they bring up higher power and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there going, I know what they're talking about. You know, this is a Christian God, you know, from Akron, Ohio. And I'm a new age kind of guy, man, you know. It just was awful. And I just agonized over it. So we get to the third step. He told me things like, he said, in the morning, get on your knees. Yeah, you bet. And ask God to keep you sober. And then if you haven't drank all day long, at the end of the night, get on your knees and you ask him or thank him for doing a good job. You know? He says, can you do that? I said, I can't do that, man. I'm sorry, but I can't do that. I said, I'd feel like a hypocrite. If I did that, I'd feel like a hypocrite. You know, because I just don't believe it. It turns my stomach. It makes me sick. God is for weaklings, for people that are afraid of death.
It's real clear. Don't you understand that? You went to college. No, I can't do it. And he says, well, if you feel like a hypocrite, tell God your fucking sponsor told you to do this. Next morning, I get up, I go in the bathroom, and I still weighed about 270 or 280, so it wasn't a pretty sight. And I got on my knees, naked. I figured if we're going to humiliate ourselves, I've never done things halfway. I locked the door for fear anybody would see me. And I knelt down next to the sink in case I gagged. And I did. And I said, God, my fucking sponsor told me to do this. Please keep me sober today. Thank you. That was my first big-time AA prayer. And I think maybe that night I said thank you because I didn't drink, and that was about it. I don't think I went 2 days in a row. I just couldn't do it. And I lied to him and told him I was doing it. He said, are you praying? I said, yeah, sure. So we get to the third step. And he took pity on me. I realized later. He took pity on me. When we got to the third step, he did not make me kneel down with him and hold my hand, as I have had the privilege and honor to do with other men today. And I asked him, why didn't you do that? He says, I don't think you could have handled it. He says, I thought about it, and it kind of scared me, so I just, you know. I think he thought he might have been struck down by lightning or something. But I said the dumb prayer, and it was over with. You know, I said, let's get on to the fourth step. Everybody's sniveling about it. Let's do it. You know, so I started writing. I sniveled about it for about a month, you know, and or some period of time, maybe longer than that. And I wrote out my inventory. Then I made the appointment with him, and I went down. And this is in Hermosa Beach. And he lives right on the Strand in an apartment there. And I go to meet him to do my fifth step. And I went up to the door and knocked on the door. And I hear this, hey, Bill. And I look, and he's sitting out. He's got two chairs sitting out in the beach on a Saturday afternoon in the middle of summer on the Strand. And I look, oh, God. And I'm all dressed up. You know, I was still lame. You ever tried to dress up right for AA meetings and stuff, you know? I went through that agony for a while. You just can't do it. It's impossible, you know, because nobody dresses all the same. So you're always wrong. And I'm in the middle of the summer, you know, I'm all dressed up, you know. It was just sad. And I went out and I sat on the beach and I told him everything. He told me we did it just like in the book. The guy never had an original thought in his whole life. Everything is like the book. You know, I've even found out some of the stuff that he told me that I thought, man, he's pretty insightful. You know, he got it from his sponsor, Fred Ellis. You know, it just was sad. And I told him all this, and he told me, he says, the thing you want to be sure you do is be sure that you tell the three or four things that you're never going to tell anybody. That they're the things that there's no reason to tell anybody. I mean, we all want to talk about the bank robberies and the murders and stuff like that and the big time stuff, you know. The bigger sleazeball you are around here, the more higher up you are, it seems like. You know, it's one thing that's neat about AA. You know, I love the stories. Mine's just boring. You know, I mean, there's really nothing there. You know, I went out and tried to kill a guy one time. Well, shit, I even screwed that up, you know. And, I've been in jail and stuff a few times. You know, I got busted for pot, and I got common drunk and stuff. You know, nothing flashy, you know. I spent 2 weeks in L.A. County one time because my old man wouldn't bail me out, you know. And I've never been back since. It's interesting. But I had nothing really to tell. But I told him those three or four things. Things that I'd done in the privacy of my own room with nobody else around. The things that I thought I was. Those were the things I thought Bill really was. A sleazy, sneaky, gross, sick kind of a person. The things I believed I was. I told him. I took that leap of faith. And I told him those things. And he didn't throw me away. And he shared back with me some of his things. And it kind of made me, changed my opinion about him a lot, you know. He's really sleazy. And I thought, God, you know, you ever stop every once in a while, especially those of you who have been around here for a while, you stop and look around at who you're sitting with, you know. I mean, after a while you get to know, like, I rode all the way down here with Bruce, and I stop and think about that now, and I'm kind of afraid to drive back with him, you know. Because I know some of his stuff, you know, but this is the beauty of this place, you know, is that we are like each other, you know, and they can't throw us out. And they don't throw us out, ever. Well, I shared that with him, and that was a big leap of faith for me. You know, I went, he told me after that, he said, now I want you to go, like it says in the book, and be quiet
for an hour and reflect on what you've done. You know, have you been fearless and thorough? Is there anything that you want to tell me that you haven't told me? You know, and reflect on that. And when you go home and you put the key in the door, think about the person that's going through your front door now compared to the person that was going through your front door when you first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went up on a hillside and I looked at the beautiful bay, and it was a beautiful summer day. I did step 6 and 7. I can never figure out how people say when they say they're stuck on 6 and 7. It's 2 paragraphs in the book. You say the dumb prayer and it's over, you know. And I did 6 and 7 in 5 minutes. And then I was on step 8. But I sat and I looked out across there and I thought, you know, man, something has happened to me. I've changed. And I went through my front door and I thought about the person I was that day compared to the person I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was different, man. I had been busy arguing and hassling and going to 2 meetings a day, 7 days a week, and sitting up all night eating sugar and drinking coffee with my buddies trying to figure this motherfucker out, man. And what does your sponsor tell you compared to what? And having all, I hadn't realized that the obsession to drink had been lifted. I hadn't realized it. I stopped and I thought, my God, isn't that interesting? Isn't that bizarre? There's 2 very bizarre things that happen to all of us. One, we have a moment of clarity. I mean, people have been telling us for years. They've been telling us for years. And finally, one day we wake up and go, oh, well, maybe it's my drinking. What a concept. You know? Then the other thing happens to us, this other bizarre thing. For me, it happened right away. The obsession to drink just gets taken away. And for me, for 25 goddamn years, I've been obsessed about it, and half that time was wonderful. I didn't care about it. You know, it was okay. You know, but I'd always been obsessed by it. Now I obsess over other stuff. You know? I mean, there are times where I'm going to play golf no matter what. You know, or I'm going to ride my bicycle or something. I just get that. I'm just that way. It's part of what makes me lovable. You know, I'm just cute like that. But I don't obsess over alcohol or drugs anymore at all. Since March the 28th, 1985. Isn't that strange? You know, and I looked at that and I thought, I didn't do that. I never asked for that. What happened for me after that is my sponsor became my higher power. I put faith in him. I trusted him. I told him all my secrets. He's now the keeper of my secrets. There's more people like that now. He's not the only one. There's more. There's a larger group now of people that know who Bill is. I have a home group who knows who I am. Most of those guys in there know who I am, you know, intimately, in depth, as much as I know about me. You know, but at that time, there was one person walking the face of this planet that he's got all the secrets, man. He's got it all. You know. We made a list of all of the amends that I owed. Most of them emotional. I didn't come to AA owing a whole lot of money. However, I did, and I paid the money back. You know, most of it that I've been able to locate the people. But we made a list of these amends that I was going to make, and on that list was my mother and my father. You know, most of us, I think, would have that on our list. And I set about to make these amends. One of the big ones I had was my ex-wife, and I hated that woman. You know, she had been messing around with my best friend. He's the guy I went out and tried to kill. You know, he's still floating around somewhere, maybe looking for me. You know, but I had to go up and make amends to her and my 2 children, whom I had abused verbally and sometimes physically, you know, and I had left them. And I flew up there, and I sat in front of her, and I apologized for breaking the trust that we had had. As my sponsor told me and a few other people that I went to, and before I went to make those amends, my sponsor talked to me about it, and then he sent me to some other people to talk to them about it, who had had the same experience. Not some intellectual construct about what I should do, but who had the same experience. And I talked with them and asked them, what did you do? Did you have a wife that you hated and you had to make amends to? How did you do that? And what I was told is, at one time you loved that woman. Yeah, I guess so. And you broke the trust, did you not? Were you not a good husband to her? Well, yeah, you know, but so what, you know? And all of a sudden you get to look at that. And I went up there and I apologized to her for that. And I took my 2 kids, and the oldest one, who's now 21, both of them have been through recovery programs. The oldest one is just an absolute mess. It's just frightening to see somebody that messed up. And when I sat in the living room with him and made my amends to him, he knew he had it coming.
He had a great attitude. He went, go ahead. You know, and I did it, man. I looked him right in the eye and I said, I'm sorry for treating you the way I've treated you, and I will no longer treat you that way. You know, and you got it coming. You know, I was a real asshole. He has dreams. He has visions of killing me real slowly with a knife and stuff, you know. And maybe that's diffused a little bit. Hopefully he won't have to wait till he's 37 or 38 years old to get that monkey off his back like I had to wait all that time. Maybe he can get rid of me quicker, you know. And but anyway, I made those amends, and when I came back, I was not the same person. I was not the same person. Around this time, or just before that, we had our first annual South Bay Roundup. And my sponsor has got, he has service problems. He's this GSR thing, and see, he does all this stuff, you know. He calls it a disease, you know, it's like an outside issue. And he's involved in all the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was on a booth down there, and I called him up one day, and I said, I got to talk to you right now, man. I really got a problem. I got to talk to you. And he told me that there was no big deals, which is what he likes to say a lot. And he met me down there at the roundup, and we were sitting in the lobby of the Marriott Hotel, and there's people going in and out of the place. And I was sitting there trying to explain in my own inimitable, long-winded way what was going on, which I really didn't know what was going on, but I was really confused and screwed up. And he looked at me and he says, do you want me to pray with you? And I said, yes, would you? And he goes, sure, how about right here? And I looked and I said, this is a lot. I looked at him, I said, you would, wouldn't you? You really would. And he goes, well, yeah, everybody would know what we were doing. And I go, please don't make me do that. So he took me around. We went down a hallway around, still in the main floor of the room. There's still people walking in and out of this place down this hallway. I mean, there's thousands of drunks in there. And we're sat on this couch. There's a shrine there now. One of these days, I'm going to put a plaque on the wall. You know? But last year, I went there, and they moved the couch, and I almost went and complained to the manager. Where's my couch, man? And we sat on this couch. He put his arm around me. We found a big book, and we did a little deep breathing. And he said the third step prayer. And I said the third step prayer, and I meant it. I really meant it. And I will always and forever cherish that experience. It'll never be the way it was that first time, I don't think. I mean, that was really special. Because I really meant it. You know, something happened in here that I didn't ask for, that I didn't think about it. I mean, I didn't think it into existence. It was something I realized somehow innately that I wasn't keeping myself sober. Now, I would still today like to take credit for that. It's this wonderful program that I work, you know, and the lineage of my sponsor and his sponsor and so on. You know, I like all that stuff, you know, and I like being a step Nazi. And my home group is the bike club that I never really was a member of, you know. We're tough. Work the steps or die, motherfucker! You know, that's who I am. I identify with that. You know, it works for me, the macho approach where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. You know? I like being a tough guy. I always wanted to be a tough guy. Now I'm an AA Nazi, you know. We have T-shirts that say Step Nazi on the front, you know. But when it really comes down home, when it comes home, ultimately, when it comes home, you know, there's a power greater than ourselves that's keeping us sober. It's certainly keeping me sober. And that's a very soft and warm feeling. There's nothing tough and harsh about it at all, you know, because what Bill really is a marshmallow inside. And I can do all the posing and all the stuff I want to do. It doesn't matter, you know. When I did my fifth step, my sponsor informed me that I was now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I brought to his feeble mind the attention that it says in the traditions that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And he says, it says in there, idiot, that that's the only requirement. Doesn't necessarily mean you're a member. There's some stuff you got to do around here, kid, if you want to be a member. You know, people coming in and out of here all day long. You know, very few of them work the steps. You've done your inventory. You're now a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went around telling everybody in his little cadre, he's in now. He's in now. He did that for me, as I've done that for other people. The guy, he's done it. He did his inventory. Now, I could stand outside the meeting and say, I've done my inventory, man. Have you? And it meant a lot to me, man. I've always wanted to feel part of. I always wanted to be part of something. And today, I believe, and I like to call myself a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a member. I'm in. I'm part of it. I'm not just posing around the fringe. I do the stuff. I don't turn down AA requests. When I'm called, I go, no matter what. It's real simple. For 4 years I've done that, and I've never been given more than I can handle. Sometimes I look like that, but it's turned out I've never been given more than I can handle. I believe that what happens in the psychic change that's talked about in a doctor's opinion, when alcoholics of our variety go out and do acts against their will, things that we don't want to do, when we return, there's no way that we can be the same. We change. We change. There's two kinds of people in AA. There's those who work the steps and those who don't. And those who don't work the steps think that there's a click. And they're right. It's those who work the steps. That's the click. That's the in-group. That's the inside crowd. It's those people, those who work the steps. You can always tell the alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous, they work the steps and their lives change. I believe that what happens, the whole thing is a third step. 3, 4, and 5 go together. We say the third step prayer. We turn it over to God. We don't have a clue what that means. We do our inventory and we look at that and we go, that's what we're turning over. We do the fifth step, we turn it over. We give it to the other person and it's turned over. It's gone. I had that experience. It left me. When I made amends to my father, I waited on his 70th birthday. It was a frightening thing for me. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say to this man at all. I waited on his 70th birthday and the people had all left the house. I took him in another room. This is all told to me to do this. You do it quick and you do it clean and leave him with the memory that you apologized. Leave the room. Talk about it later at some other time, but don't continue the conversation after you've made the amends. Do it and get out and leave him with that memory. I went in, I sat down with him, and I said, look, he's told me, he says, you don't have to do this. And I said, you better than anybody know that I have to do this. Don't tell me that. You know. And I told him, I'm sorry that I wasn't the son that you wanted me to be. I'm sorry that I got in your face. And I didn't list all the events. He was there. He remembers. You know. I said, you're my father. I love you. I don't want to hate you anymore. I left the room. I walked out. I got in the car, and I started crying driving home. My wife was sitting there with me, and it just left me. It left me. That hatred just left. I mean, I will never forget that experience. My life has never been the same. Thank God I did that before he died. They're still around. But thank God I have a relationship with my parents today. I made the amends, you know, and I've done that. And I've been relieved of that burden, of that bondage of self. All those resentments and anger and pain, that's all bondage of self. And it's all ego crap, you know, and the ego is just waiting. Waiting, it feeds on that stuff, and it doesn't want us to go out there and make these moves. When we make the moves, we come back, we're not the same. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. I am conscious of the fact that my life has been saved. My sponsor told me that the reason that I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous is that they needed better transportation. I drive the AA assault vehicle. Whenever we go, I drive. I'm the one with the Cadillac. Why would we ride in anybody else's car? So we go get him in the Cadillac. We've gone on 12-step calls. He called me up in the middle of the night one night. He says, I got a 12-step call from the central office. Let's go. He never asked me, do you want to go? Let's go. Be here in 5 minutes. I get up out of bed and I go with him and we went and we get this guy out in Wilmington somewhere, you know, sitting on a stoop with a few beers. He'd just been rolled. He was all beat up. You know, there's been a series of those events. On Memorial Day weekend a couple of years ago, I was waking in the middle of the night. It was about midnight. There's a 12-step call in a hotel room down on Western in Gardena. So I picked up another friend of mine. He came over to my house, and we drove there. And it's in the middle of the night. It's Memorial Day weekend. There's drunks all over the streets. It's in Gardena. And it's a Clint Eastwood movie hotel, man. You know, I mean, we walk in the front door and there's doors with padlocks on them all the way down the hall. You know, you can just see old Clint going down the hallway, you know. And I'm looking down this hallway. I'm scared to death. There's people screaming down. You can hear some woman screaming and people are banging the walls and stuff like this. The place stunk. There's beer cans all over the place. My friend Derek's standing behind me like about 10 feet by the door looking down this thing. And I stood at that hallway and I didn't know which room the guy was in. And I looked down the hall, and I just closed my eyes and said, God, you gotta help me now, because there's no way I'm going down that hallway. You know, and if I'm going down that hallway, it ain't gonna be alone. You gotta do something now. And it just was lifted. The fear was gone. And I just walked down the hall. And I can remember feeling that. I felt that. It wasn't anything that I thought.
It was something I felt. And I just knew I was going to be okay. And it worked out. I mean, it just worked out. Today, I believe that when I'm on those things, as it talks about in the book, I believe I'm protected. I believe that. I don't know if it's a lame feeling. Like, I've become the weakling I thought everybody else was. You know, and I just give it up when I can. I mean, there's no way anybody, what we talk about up here and what we do is a lot of two different things. But these are the experiences I've had that have changed my life. On another occasion, there was an old drunk standing outside the Alano Club, and he was babbling and moaning. He'd been around for a few days bumming money off of people. And he was out there, and he was drunk, and my sponsor was standing there talking to him, and he said, if I find you a bed in one of these halfway houses, will you go? And the guy says, yeah. So there's another guy standing there, and the old drunk kind of wandered off, and I said to this guy, I said, this guy's not serious. Why the hell are we wasting our time on him? He's just bumming money. And this guy looked at me, he got in my face, he says, who the fuck are you? Jesus, you know. He says, that's just the way I was when I got here. Where do you think you are, kid? This is Alcoholics Anonymous. If he can't come here, where can he go? If he can't come here, where can he go? Are you gonna help this man or what? You know? Are you just a bunch of hot air? Oh, gee, I'm sorry. You know? My sponsor comes down and says, we got a bed for you. And he looked at me and he says, go get your car. Now, I don't mind working with drunks. I like the clean ones. This guy stunk, man. He's been sleeping in the bushes for a long time. You know, I go get my car. I pull up. They open the back door, throw his bedroll in. They open the front door and they throw him, and nobody else got in the car. My sponsor's wife came around the driver's side, handed me some cheese and crackers, and she said, if he wants to eat, hand him this. Don't stop for anything. And I took off driving this guy to the way back in. On the way there, I thought he was going to rape me and stab me and kill me, you know. And it never occurred to me that he was frightened. It never occurred to me that he was frightened. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know where he was going. And he said to me while we were in the car, he said, what happened to me? I used to be married and I had some children and stuff. What happened to me? You know, suddenly I looked at him closer and he wasn't as old as I thought he was. He was probably my age. But he looked awful, you know, the way we look. By the time we got to the way back in, I was holding the guy's hand. We took him into the way back in. The guy was signing him up. I said to the guy, I said, you're going to take care of my friend, aren't you? He goes, oh, yeah, we'll take care of him. And I'm holding this guy's hand. He's trying to eat the cheese and crackers with one hand, and I got a hold of this guy. This is my alcoholic, man. This one was for me, you know. When I left him there, I got in my car, and I was probably 10 miles from home, and I said a prayer of gratitude all the way home, you know. And it wasn't, thank you, God, that I'm not him. That wasn't the prayer, you know. It was, thank you, God, for saving my life so I could be here to have these experiences. You know, I'd always talked about doing shit, and now I'm finally doing it. They'll even let you stand up here as if you know something and talk to a large group of people. And I love it. I think it's fun. I enjoy it. I like the thrill of it. You know, I love to go on 12-step calls because I can go. Other people can't go, but I can go. I can do it. You know? So I get to do those things. Other people do other things. It isn't important which job you do in AA. It's just important you do one. You know, there's only three things here, man, you know, to me. You go to meetings, you work the steps, and you get commitments so that you can stay. If you have commitments, you have to go to the meetings, even when you don't want to go. And there's been times I don't want to go to the meetings. There's a thing that comes from a brother organization, CA, that everybody loves to do here is to repeat, you know, principles before personalities, you know. Cocaine people need that. They have a lot of personality problems, you know. And it's come into A, and everybody loves to repeat it. And I wonder if anybody knows what that really means, why we repeat that, or why it's so important. The fellowship is only personalities. That's all it is. It's just a bunch of people in a room. And I will cop resentments against you like I have any other group, and you'll do the same with me, and pretty soon I'll be gone. Unless I have some principles. The principles are in the steps. There's a lot of them. Talk to your sponsor. He'll tell you what they are. But the principles will allow us to survive the goddamn fellowship because it'll kill us. Because they're just like any other group. It comes to, you reach a point, or I reached a point where the meetings weren't enough. The personalities weren't enough. All the warmth, the pseudo-warmth. You know, I mean, we're all staying sober together and we're going to expect that we're going to get something more than that out of it. And that's all there is here is sobriety. The only constant that we may have in our lives is this power greater than ourselves. the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous have changed my life. It has created a psychic change in me to where I do not any longer perceive the world the way I used to, so that I don't need the anesthetic to survive it any longer. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God for you. Thank you.